Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary and much missed musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest or guests to chat about their experience and memories of the group. If you're wondering, we consist of me, Paul Hanley, and my brother Steve, who as you probably know was a member of The Fall for 20 years. As always, you can find us at the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. Hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the latest episode of the of Old Brother, The Fall podcast, with me, Paul Hanley, and the ever-legendary Stephen Hanley.
The Fall podcast.
What? What? A Fall podcast? Another one, is there?
No.
We're only 2 weeks in, give it a chance. Right, so, quickly on to A Fall podcast. So we've got lucky enough to have two guests today. So I've got to say, Steve, I hope you've got some good questions, because these are proper writers, these, not the stuff you write, you know. And then
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, proper book and everything, these two. Right, without further ado, I shall introduce you to Tessa Norton, writer and author of, amongst other things, The Fields Here Are Full of Ghosts. Although that's not quite a book, is it? I didn't really know how to describe it. Is it an author? Is it a curator? Is it? Anyway, we'll get on to that. And Bob Stanley, who is a musician in St. Etienne, obviously, wrote Yeah, 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 Story of Modern Pop, and I believe he's working on the prequel, which I don't know how far back it goes, Madrigals, I'm not so sure. But we'll get on to that. And obviously, they are the editors of a new book about The Fall, not the new book about The Fall, a new book about The Fall, Excavate, The Wonderful and Frightening World of The Fall, which contains a lot of interesting essays and posters and all kinds of stuff, but we'll get into all that. The other thing we need to say about Bob is he's an old pen pal of mine. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, we correspond regularly, once every 40 years.
he's telling me something right back.
I tell you, it is interesting. This will tell you everything you need to know. He wrote to The Fall, and I wrote back in 1982 or something. I sent him a letter and a poster. Guess which he's still got, guess which one he's lost. See if he can work out. good afternoon. Are you well, you two?
Yeah, we are, thanks.
Good, thanks, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
is it all going well with the book?
Yes, I think it's going all right. It seems to be going down well. Obviously, you know, it's one of those things. You've no idea what people are going to think of it once you send it out. You know, send it out into the world. Yeah, I don't know. It got called pretentious in a good way the other day, which I was quite pleased about.
Well, that's all right. Yeah,
it's a compliment, and that's fine with that. I think we knew it was quite an idiosyncratic book, and you know the Fall's. You know, seemed like they deserved nothing less. So, you're never sure kind of how it's going to land, whether people will be expecting more of a conventional biography or something like that. But no, people seem to be enjoying its approach, which is great.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, because I'm not so sure how many bands you could do a book like this about.
I was thinking the same thing this morning, yeah, trying to think of other bands.
Yeah, it's
pretty... The Beatles would be the obvious one, wouldn't it? Mm.
What's that?
The Beatles, you could probably write a book about that.
They probably exist already, don't they? I mean, it's like, even then, though, I think the amount of, like, subject matter that's sort of covered in full songs, apart from anything else, you know, the Beatles don't cover that huge amount of subject matter. It's mostly love songs.
Oh, it's not as surprising. You know, there's so many, like, references that kind of spin off from the Fool's Work. That's sort of what we've
got. I don't think there's any Beatles songs about aftershave, is there?
Anyone can think of one, right?
You realise you've just distracted me now. I'm going to spend the next hour thinking of a terrible pun on aftershave. I'll get back to you. I'll let the back half of my brain work on that while we talk. But I might, if I interrupt you and shout something out, it'll be an aftershave that's a pun of a beer.
An aftershave thought, will it?
Yeah. because I was going to say that there's not a lot of bands you could get something like Mark Fisher's essay and then an essay about comparing it to amateur football and Joseph Boys. I mean, you'd struggle with that, wouldn't you, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
You would. I think we wanted it to be, the essays that we commissioned to be like a very wide-ranging essay collection, like in their own right. And I can't think of many other bands that would kind of suggest that. A couple of people have said Dylan, obviously like a really different artist, but I suppose there's maybe that similar thing of lots of like buried references. But again, I'm sure all that's been picked over by, you know, the Bobcats over the years.
Hasn't been a book.
Who published mine and Steve's books, they got almost the cottage industry in itself doing Bob Dylan books. I mean, you can write, people have written everything about Bob Dylan, haven't they, I think?
Yeah.
Getting that way with the Fall, I think, but there you go.
Yeah, definitely now.
I like this, that we're being talked about in the same vein as Bob Dylan and the Beatles.
you're the Pete Best of this story.
No,
well, I can't say that, can I? Because if you're Pete Best, what does that make me? One of the quarry men, I suppose. The one who went on to fit carpets, that'll be me. The one thing we normally ask on these things is how you first came across the Fall. So if we do that individually, Tessa, what was your first experience with the Fall?
The first album I bought was Perverted by Language when I was about 13. Might have even been, about 13. I'd read, it was that kind of first couple of years when you start reading the music press and you're trying to kind of piece together what had kind of come before you. I just dived in and I was, I thought it was one of the most exciting things I'd ever heard. It felt like, I'd been like allowed into kind of back room somehow that was much more kind of like exciting than anything that had got me to that point.
So how far after the fact was that then? How far after it was released?
That would have been, I was born in 1981, I'm 40, so that would have been about 10 years after it was released, I suppose. Is that my maths?
It's about probably slightly less, I think.
A bit less, yeah.
But the big question there is, did you go forward or back from there?
A bit of both, actually. Probably back first and then jump forward a bit and kind of zigzag for the next kind of few years until I kind of like caught up. You know, I think already at that point it felt like, you know, a big and expansive sort of body of work. And, you know, I was, you know, obviously like John Peel was still going and friends with all that. And, you know, it felt like a very important thing to know about. But it also felt like kind of world that you have to discover for yourself a little bit. What do you think, Bob? You were pretty the same sort of age.
I was a little bit older. The first record I bought was Total's Turns. And I hadn't heard anything off it. I just, you know, because, you know, the Fall didn't get played on the radio very much. And I was like, I was 15, so I was like, I wasn't listening to John Peel quite yet. It was probably just before I started listening to him. But I bought it just because I'd read about the Fall and it sounded really interesting. And I liked the cover. And it was secondhand, so it was cheap. And I bought it, and I couldn't work out what on earth I was listening to at first. It's just like I didn't like it at all. But I kept playing it, and then got into it. And then Slates came out, was the next new record to come out, which I absolutely loved. And that was it, basically. Then they all became a favourite group.
That's a weird one to start with, Total's Turns. That.
Yeah, it probably was, wasn't it? I mean, like, it's obviously like, you know, like Rauch, Rumble, Fiery Jack are pretty catchy, but it's not the most obvious way to first listen to them.
I'm not sure that they're massively catchy in the versions that are on Total's
Turns. No.
What's the most common kind of jumping on point for people?
I don't know. Because
I don't think there is one, is there? You get a lot of people say that, yeah, the favourite album is the first one they bought.
Yeah.
But
which begs the question, why did you buy it then, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just the thing. It's like, I mean, like, yeah, like I was just saying, it's like, I couldn't hear the full. I mean, unless I probably wasn't even that aware of John Peel at this point. I was basically buying Smash Hits and Record Mirror, though I wasn't even buying NME. And it just seemed intriguing, and I wanted to know what they sounded like. And it must, you know, certainly around that time, I kind of been the only person doing that. It was just so hard to hear a lot of stuff back then. It's like it's easy to take it for granted now that you can just obviously press a button and listen to absolutely anything, but it was really not the case then.
Do you think that's, I mean, a bigger question than just a podcast about the fall, but do you think music's lost some value in the fact that you can get everything everywhere all the time now? There was some kind of mystique about it, maybe, when you couldn't get hold of it very easily?
Yeah.
It was some kind of event, wasn't it, when something came out and you had to track it down and actually go to the shop and...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's different now. I mean, it's just changed, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, you still get, well, it's not that recently, but like when Beyonce did the Lemonade album, it was just like came out of nowhere and no one was expecting it. So you have to like sort of like be quite creative to have any kind of mystique around what you're doing, because everything is so, as soon as there's a sniff of something being recorded, then people are talking about it on social media. But you had to buy the, yeah. Back then, it was like an old man, but you had to buy the music paper every week and go through the news and new releases, and then you'd see what was coming and get excited about it.
Yeah. I think some of it is an old man thing, you know, like saying, does it take my 78s and all that kind of thing? You don't. I definitely think there's something about the fact that you can say, oh, what was the B-side of this record? And you go to Spotify and it's there straight away.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a sheen gone off things. I think so, anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's definitely lost something.
I'm not saying it's worse or better, but it's just different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just different. Yeah. And I think, you know, people are trying to recreate that as well now, which I think means that people do miss it.
Well, I mean, vinyl's been back crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. And like the cassette thing, you know, you think, well, that's just like cassettes were always rubbish, really. It's just people are just trying to get some kind of, I don't know, texture or something to music that's beyond just listening to it.
I think it's also like an element of discovery as well, though, isn't it? It's like not feeling like everything in the world is out there, and you know, you're like in this, like a kid in this enormous supermarket where you're like, oh, I don't know what to listen to. It's quite nice to kind of go on these little trails of like, you know, looking at back of a EP that you've just bought and finding out who the label was and what else have they put out and what's coming next.
That is certainly true of the fall, isn't it? Because it was like sort of being part of a underground club that no one else had heard about.
Yeah.
And the same with like getting into writers and stuff like that. You know, I pre-internet, I remember just like sitting on the floor in Waterstones in New York for like hours, just kind of like following little trails in books and like not buying anything because you know. Yeah. You're a kid, but you know, you sit there kind of like reading about whatever they've got in. And I think I wanted this book to feel a little bit like that, actually, that kind of analog way of like following little thinning threads. Or, you know, you read something in a Mark Fisher essay, oh, I want to go back and read that story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely what we both got from The Fall. I think it's like there were so many things that you could like pick out. And I said this to someone the other day, but it sounds hilarious now. But when I first heard Spectre versus Rector, which would be on Total's Turns, I suppose. I thought it was Elmore James instead of M.R. James. I had no idea who M.R. James was then. There's things like that, and when you do find out who these people are, it leads you down these different routes, and everyone who gets into The Fall, I think, finds different routes to go down. Like, no one has the same, I'm sure you find this, but no one has the same story. Everyone has a different story about how I got into the fall and what I got out of the fall.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, funnily enough, we were talking to obviously been talking to various people from the fall, and we were talking to the guy who was the drummer, the last drummer of the fall, Kieran, and his experience of the fall is pretty much completely different from ours. I mean, that's just different members of the band. So
yeah,
from the outside is incredible, really.
Yeah,
and it's obviously there's so many of you alumni and so many sort of stories to tell as well. It's vast. It's you could go on forever and you could do kind of hundreds of books talking about all that.
Yeah, so I mean,
the stuff we went to for collections was all fans. So it's not the most valuable items. It's not the most it's not mint condition records or anything like that. It's this is stuff that's just been taped to people's bedroom walls or that they've saved in their shoebox since they were 16, and the stuff that becomes quite important to you as an object. So we wanted to kind of keep some of that stuff that's like precious to people, even if it's not like physically valuable. So that's kind of what the visuals of the book are made up of.
That was a big thing that struck me, is that with a lot of the stuff that's in here is how nothing basically I kept. I think you're the same. No,
me too. I do find it incredible that people have held on to this stuff for so long and it is important to them.
I wish I had a loft full of original press totally wired, I tell you. I wouldn't have a loft full of original pressing totally wired for long, let's put it that way. We were talking about that the other day. Steve had the Ideal for Living, the original.
Oh, yeah.
With the paper sleeve.
Yeah.
And he gave it away. Who did you give it away to?
I've been thinking since. I cannot even remember who I gave it to.
And it was estimates between £1,500 and
£2,500. That's nuts, isn't it? You never know. You never know what's going to be valuable. And I've got rid of records.
You did it a week, didn't you?
Yeah, I gave away a record the other way. I had a stall at a record fair. This is very boring. I had a stall at a record fair. It's got rid of tons of 7-inches, like 60s, 70s things. I couldn't even remember what they sounded like. And then just like, of course, as soon as I'd done that, I just looked one up and it just sold for £500. Someone will be here.
Hopefully you made someone's day.
Yeah.
Or they've made a fruit bowl out of it.
I had a poster for the fall supporting The Cure at the Rainbow. I had that for quite a while. Funnily enough, when I got married, I was going to get it framed and put on the wall, but Julie wasn't that massively keen and I went up in the room. But I got rid of that, and I think that's worth some money now as well. But I can't believe, one man's trash is another man's riches. But there's just the amount of stuff there is now. I don't know if that's a consequence of music not being a thing anymore. But people just crave stuff, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, because I mean, like the stuff was always there, I suppose. I mean, I used to try and get set lists and posters and try and keep flyers, but never sent Etienne once. I've hardly got anything of ours either. I know what you mean, but it's
you tend to not, though, don't you, when you're in it, when you're sort of in the middle of it all.
Yeah, well, especially if you're doing a gig, the first thing you do when you come to stage is not to try and take a poster off the wall. It's like, which fans do when they're leaving. You're the last person who's going to do that. So, yeah, it's quite hard to pick up things like that, I suppose.
I tell you what, I bet young bands now are thinking, everything's about a way to monetize it. Oh, right, we've got our set list here. So we collect all them in. They can sell all of them. Get that poster down. Sign the back of that. You can see it. Because people are selling the sound checks now, aren't they?
Are they? Bloody. Yeah.
You can get a VIP invite. You come and watch the sound check.
Oh, yeah, no, of course you're right. Yeah, inviting people in, yeah.
I wouldn't pay to watch you going bum, bum, bum for 20 minutes, Paul.
I'll tell you what, it'd be a bit of fraud. Sometimes getting a full sound check might be an interesting experience.
Oh, you pay for that.
20 minutes apart, picking the gaffer's tape off the stage.
Before, yeah.
We did talk about that, Kieran, the other night. He said we used to do a sound check, and Mark would turn up and he'd come along and he'd say, "That's great, that. Can you just move the drum kit 12 inches to the left?" Yeah, no problem. Why he couldn't have moved 12 inches to the right, I'm not so sure, but there you go.
It wasn't the point.
That definitely was not the point, no. So I was going to say, Tessa, you're the odd one out here. You're the only person on this podcast who hasn't played Shockstock live on stage.
That's true, yet.
I was listening to the end version. I was expecting it to be sort of ironic, you know, because the words are barely out. But it's completely straight, isn't it? The way it's played, it's great, by the way.
It's a long time ago. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things about The Fall that I love is that, like, I think I read two different things with Mark talking about Chockstock. One which we put in the book, where he says, you know, he says it's not really ironic, and he's like, he quite likes the idea that kids are into pop music for the sake of pop music rather than being sniffy and, you know, listening to Jim Morrison and sulking or whatever. But I'm pretty sure I don't know what he was thinking when he wrote the lyrics, but we just thought we'd do it straight. Because obviously we're a pop group and that's why we did it. But yeah, I think I wrote to him when we did it. I wrote to him to make sure it was okay, because I didn't want him to like hear it and then say something really negative about us in the press. And I think from the letters in the book, I mean, obviously you two are going to know this much better than we do, but he seemed to quite like it when people did things in the proper way like that. So like, I wrote a letter to him and put my number on. And he called back and went, "Yeah, of course you can do what you want with it. I don't mind, but yeah, thanks for writing." That's about as close as I ever got to chatting to him, really. But
he'd have been calling, he'd have ripped you a new one, wouldn't he, in the press? Let's face.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. We really, really didn't want that to happen because we're big fans. He seemed to appreciate that anyway.
I think there's a big thing with Mark where whatever people say, I am, that's what I'm not. I think.
Yeah,
and he was a big thing with manners, I think. So I mean, I think he would have.
He would have appreciated that. Just the fact that you letting him know about it and making sure it was all right.
That's kind of what we.
I don't remember him ever writing to the guy who wrote Mr. Pharmacist. Maybe he did.
Did he read the book who wrote Mr. Pharmacist?
Pardon?
Did he read the man who wrote Mr. Pharmacist? I was going to ask, did Sarah have much trouble getting the notes Steve's backing vocals on Chockstock? Because it's a high register, isn't it?
It's a long time ago. I think her voice was pretty bad off as well. So
I went down a complete rabbit hole once I started listening to that. I think obviously with Etienne. I then got on to Only Love Can Break Your Heart, and then I got Elkie Brooks, would you believe it? So I've been complete rabbit hole with Elkie Brooks because she's obviously from Manchester, and she's like one of those artists that's been there forever, but you never really think about.
Did you ever
write
to Neil Young?
No, we tried to see if Neil Young had ever heard it at least, and it's because we're on the same label in America at the time, but couldn't ever get a response. But he had heard it because he played it on a radio station with. This is really going down a rabbit hole, sorry. I think it's Randy Bachman from Bachman Turner Overdrive has his own radio station in Canada, where he's more famous than he is here. And Neil Young was a guest because it's all about Canada, and they played that. So we know at least he's aware of it, yeah.
He didn't say, get this trash off, did he?
Hopefully not. No, I don't know what he said.
Didn't not say that.
It took us 30 years to find out if he was even aware of it, so we were quite pleased to find that out.
So, we were supposed to be talking about The Fall, weren't we? Did you ever meet Mark then, Bob?
I met him once. We did a PA really early on at the Sub Club in Glasgow, and when I came out from backstage, he was at the bar. So I just went up and introduced myself and said, "Oh, what do you think of us?" He said, "I didn't watch the band. I just came here because it's a late license."
So what year would that have been?
1990, that would have been.
Yeah, that is. I think that was when we were in Glasgow for a month recording Code Selfish.
Ah, right.
And we were all in a flat, and we'd go to after the recording sessions, we'd go to the Sub Club, just all taking off at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great. It was really, really, really
up stuff. And
You lived in a flat together.
In that recording studio in Glasgow, and ended up scrapping it all. I don't know if that had anything to do with the sub club or not. Yeah.
As I say, we were talking to Kieran, and he was saying that by the time he was in the band, the fall, they went in the studio with nothing and wrote and did everything there and then, which that was unheard of, certainly when I was in the band.
Yeah, that never happened.
Because that's how you work, Bob, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, but I mean, like, we'll have ideas before we go in. It's like, you know, the three of us all have an idea of a song and then we work on it together. But, yeah, we don't tend to go in with no ideas.
I don't know how that works. I mean, it clearly worked for them, but I can't imagine what you do. Certainly as a drummer, what do you do? Right, I've got this idea. How do you write this? Because there must be pressure on. Because if you're thinking about what's the most expensive room you could be in to write songs, then, I mean, I know it's slightly different, but it's not all live instruments. But I've never got that. It must be expensive. It must be an expensive way of doing it.
And the clock's ticking and you're aware that it's...
Yeah.
If you have an unproductive day, you're like...
So how's it used to work with you then? It was like, what did you go to the studio with? Like,
what would you say, Steve? 70% of it?
Yeah. We generally have about 7 songs already to go and worked up, and then there'd be 3 or 4 loose ideas that we'd work on in the studio. I mean, it obviously was different for every album, but generally that was it.
Yeah. You'd work on them in rehearsals then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark usually had one thing that he'd made up on the spot that you had to sort of try and turn into a song, like Bug Day or something, but which I never liked, but there you go. But so was that the way all the way through then, Steve, even towards the end?
Yeah, well, my last album, Levitate, we had at least five or six of them ready before we went in.
That's quite spontaneous, Levitate, I think.
Wasn't the best recording.
Idiosyncratic.
I really like it.
I really like it as well. It sort of stands out for being quite bonkers, isn't it?
But you can't.
You think that about Fall albums, they are good. I mean, Mark used to say that, but they are. They do capture the sort of where the bands are at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they definitely sound
like that. They were like his diary.
You've had trouble divorcing that, though, haven't you? And listening to an album sort of objectively.
Well, it took me years. It took me years to get over it.
Which one did you have a good experience? Did you have a good experience on then? Would you say?
Loads. That was great, Matt, making Cold Selfish. But I fondly remember making the Infotainment Scan as being a good time. Extricate. And of course, the earlier ones with you.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering when you get right at them.
The early ones with you and Mark and Craig.
That was, I mean, my thing was, it was just getting in the studio was the big thing. But did you find it hard to keep the interest up? Because it wasn't like, there wasn't even a gap where you could miss it, was there, with the fall? It was just full on all the time, really, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It was pretty much.
So it never got like, oh, not another bloody album.
I don't think I ever thought that, no.
Perhaps you should have.
Maybe I should have done.
But, I mean, it's quite...
We could have lived, we could have had a few months off.
Because I was going to say, if you're looking at bands that last as long as The Fall, it's very rare that they're as busy as The Fall. So if you say, if you look at, say, Dexys, for instance, or The Cure, years where they didn't do anything at all, but there's no years where The Fall didn't do anything, is
No, it? So what were they doing?
I don't know. You'd have to, we'll have to go on The Cure podcast and find out.
Is that with them bands of that size where they do the album, then they spend 2 years touring it, then they start working on the next one, and so it seems like a long time.
Yeah, but I mean,
it must be like a cycle that you get into, like whatever group you're in, there'll be like a regular frequency. But yeah, I can't think of one that's like as tightly wound as.
No, we didn't think that an album a year was actually that much.
I don't think it is. It's not, I mean.
No, yeah, okay. I mean, especially when there's like 4 people writing the music.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there was a fair bit of pressure on Mark to come up with all those lyrics. But when you've got 4 people writing the music and it's only 3 songs each, and I think, you know, if you can't come up with 3 songs, you can't really call yourself a musician, can you?
When bands get to a certain level, I think it's like, you know, the album comes out, then they tour, then they tour South America or something, if they're The Cure or whatever. And it's like, you know, the cycle for each album is like this gets longer and longer, and then like some people are going to have kids and disappear for 6 months or whatever. But I suppose that's how things slow down. Because, you know, like The Cure would have done an album a year in the late 70s, early 80s, wouldn't they? It's just that when they got bigger and there's like more responsibilities, I suppose, it slowed down. But yeah, I mean, The Fall is like the one group I can think of that never did slow down like that. And also, I suppose record companies don't really want you to do an album a year because...
No, well, they didn't. I was going to say that Cold Selfish album was the last one we did when we were on Phonogram.
Yeah.
They didn't like that at all. An album a year.
the only one who broke the contract by releasing too many.
Too many albums.
Did anyone ever tell you to slow down?
Well, they tried, yeah. So they did try, but Mark left.
Right, right. Yeah. And then did the infotainment scan after that?
Yeah, that was on like a smaller label, yeah, on Permanent Records.
Yeah.
So do you reckon that there's a finite amount of money to be made? So if you make less albums, you sell more of them? And then that was because it was just different business model. I mean, well, if you can use the words business model about The Fall, you'd rather sell two albums, half as many each, than just keep selling the same album. Do you think that was part of
that's
it?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a good business model to me. Well, not a business model, but it's creatively, it's a lot more interesting than slogging the same album for 4 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can never understand why bands do that voluntarily myself. It's must get incredibly boring.
As an artist, you must be so sick of it as well. Because I think, the minute something comes out, you know, you tend to want to work on the next thing, don't you?
Well, generally, we were halfway through. By the time that last album came out, we were halfway on the next one.
Yeah.
Sometimes I thought we've got rid of this. A lot, there was a fair few I thought we got rid of this too soon. I was just getting into it.
Mm.
You know, as soon as you'd learn it properly, you know, so you go and record it and then start playing it live or whatever. By the time you learn it properly, it was gone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was one of the things with, you know, and I don't think Mark was massive. Well, I know he wasn't massively pleased with The Extricated, but some of the songs there, it was never like we were stepping on The Fall's toes, because half of that stuff, The Fall had dropped within like 2 months of writing it.
I think the first time I saw The Fall was like late 81, and it was like all Hex Induction Hour stuff, and that obviously hadn't come out at that point. So I got the feeling that you were playing, most of what you were playing live was stuff that hadn't even been released yet. I saw you again in 82 with the birthday party.
Oh, where was that?
Hammersmith Palais.
Oh, my favourite gig, that.
Really?
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. That was such a great gig, wasn't it?
It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
The encore was longer than the set. It was. I'm reliably informed that the encore went on longer than the original set. And most of that was on this day, I think.
Yeah. Right, that's amazing. Makes sense.
Oh, that was a killer, that. Jesus, but that's true, because when we did, by the time we were doing Australia at the end of that year, it was most of X Induction Hour had gone.
Mm.
I mean, we had like songs, because when we did Room to Live, but after X Induction Hour, which kind of marked trying to reset things a bit. But we didn't know any of them songs. We had other songs that we were playing live, like Surrogate Mirage and Backdrop and stuff like that, that actually never.
Landed on? No.
I don't know. Surrogate Mirage.
I'm not surprised you played it twice.
No, never heard that. No.
I tell you what, I found one the other day that I was looking at something, and I found a false set with a song in that I have no. If you put a gun to my head and said, "What's this song? He Talks," it's called. I wouldn't have a clue. I think we played it twice or something, and I would not have the first idea what it is. Have you ever heard of it, Steve?
The name's vaguely familiar, but I couldn't whistle it.
Yeah, but we did two albums in a year, and there still wasn't enough room to put everything out that The Fall was like.
Yeah.
So when you say Room to Live was a reset, what was the thinking there?
Well, the big theory is, and there's a really good book about the recording of X Induction Hour, but we did X Induction Hour.
That's not why we're here.
I'm not mentioning the title. We did that, and it got really good press. And Mark, there was this thing that Mark said it was going to be the last album we were ever going to do, but I think he said that after the event. I think we certainly knew nothing about it. But it got really good press, and then it was getting used. So you'd read a review of Echo and the Bunnymen, and you'd compare it to X Induction Hour and things. So then we went in and did the complete opposite. We did Room to Live, so Mark could have me and Steve in one day and not tell Craig or Mark to turn up, and then be another guitarist there. And we didn't know any of the songs, and we recorded them like the second time we'd heard them. It was horrible, to be honest.
But yeah.
Like a deliberate attempt to derail any kind of idea that we were suddenly moving mainstream. I think that was a deliberate thing. I mean, it was quite clever, really. It wasn't very nice at the time, but I think the fall always relied on not being quite there, I think. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, because I've got to say, Room to Live wasn't I was pretty disappointed when that came out.
So was I. There's a song on there called Papal Visit, which I've never actually heard. That's really? it's like a bugbear of mine. I'm going to go to my grave having never heard it. You can play it at a funeral. Check, I'm dead. So if they play that, if I don't push the coffin lid out and jump out, then you know I'm really dead.
I said no.
Have you ever heard it, see? Because we're not on it, are we?
I thought I was on it.
How would I not heard it?
Pardon?
How would I not heard it?
I think I'm on Papal Visit, yeah.
Oh, yeah? What do you play on? It's
just me, Mark, and Carl, and he's got Mark's playing the violin, isn't he?
Well, I knew Mark was playing the violin, and I knew Carl was on it, but I didn't
know. I'm on it, yeah.
Just you, you bloody Quisling. You were on everything then. That's everything.
How's it sound in your head? You imagined it.
If you listen to the Hotel Blondel, and then you strip Bricks off and just have Mark violin and Mark's vocal, that's what I imagine Papal Visit sounds like. But I have no clue. I mean, it could be a waltz, it could be anything. I've no idea. I mean, if it was Carl, it's going to be a bit strange, because Carl was doing a lot of writing then, wasn't he?
He was.
He got his feet well under the bleeding table there. Culmination of that was we went to Australia, and then Mark Riley.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, he thought, you know, the reasons he gave were probably not true, that he was wanted to play the hits, which, you know, Mark Riley wanted to play pop. I don't know if you've ever heard Mark Riley and the Creepers, but if you want any evidence that Mark Riley didn't want to play pop, just listen to a couple of them.
Yeah.
So that was, but I think it kind of worked. You know, that's the thing. If you stand back at the end of it all and say Mark's decisions, most of the time, I think they work. You'd agree with that, Steve, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a long time and a lot of decisions here. But however great that was with Bricks, and it was, and Marsha, and it was great, but there's something about that lineup with me, you, and Craig, and Mark Riley that could have, that if Room to Live hadn't got in the way, could have gone somewhere else, I think.
Yeah.
Because those three or four albums up to that are all really good, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I have no answer to this, but would the fall have lasted 40 years if it was how it was going to go?
It's like the labyrinth, though, isn't it? There's loads of directions it could have gone off in that you'll never know the answer to, because the course of action that happened was the only one that we'll ever know about. Now you get kind of that hindsight over the whole group's career. But, yeah, there's probably loads of different directions it all could have gone in, you know, if things had fallen differently, or if Mark's, you know, master plan had been slightly different. But that's, I guess, with hindsight, that's one of the things that's so interesting about it.
It is, yeah. Because I always thought that first lineup, you know, Live at the Witch Trials, I thought they could have been like U2. I mean, not that we need another U2, but they had the kind of chops musically. They could have been massive, I think, with Carl and Martin Brahma on guitar. I mean, whether it became a different thing, didn't it? And I'm not loath to say which is better, but I think the world needs the Fall, as it turned out, more than it needs another really good rock band. You know?
Yeah, I think so. And the first album really sort of sticks out now, I think. The more the castle built up, the first album really sort of stuck out like a sore thumb, really, I think. It sounds like a pretty... conventionally recorded alternative rock album or whatever.
I mean, it wasn't that conventionally recorded, to be honest. I mean, the thing about it was they had 5 days in the studio in London, and Mark lost his voice. I mean, Martin reckons it was psychosomatic. He says it on the album, I have a psychosomatic voice, that the pressure on them to do the first album was that Mark couldn't speak for a week. So they had one day to record it. So they did the whole thing in one day.
Right. But yeah, it's not that convincing. No.
But it does sound, I don't know, it does sound like sort of got a kind of a sheen on it that nothing else has really.
Yeah. And with hindsight, you're definitely like, oh, right, it got a lot weirder after that.
Yeah. You know?
And at the time, it pretty, you know, I didn't hear it first. You know, I started, you know, a little way in and then went back and read it.
I think Mark Riley always says that the Dragnet lineup, that was when Mark, that was what he, that's what the sound he had in his head rather than what, because obviously the Witch Trials was a bit more democratic, really. And you could, you know, at that point, you wouldn't have said Mark was any more important than Martin or Carl or whoever, you know. Mm. It was after that, it kind of got Mark, Mitt, and the Fall, if you like. Not that it was ever built with that, nor should it have been, but it was kind of more Mark's idea of what he wanted a band to be, I think.
It definitely comes across like that. Anyway.
One thing I was really surprised about, because obviously we're doing the podcast, I've listened to lots of Fall all the way through. Well, for a long time, I never really listened to the Fall past 1998 for some reason. I can't remember what happened in 1998, but I never really. That last 10 years of the Fall or whatever, the last lineup, I've been listening to them a lot. They're, yeah, fantastic. I was absolutely blown away, to be honest, because I was expecting it to be just more of the Fall, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he kind of solved the puzzle, I think, Mark. He got it, so he didn't have to. He was not interested in sacking anybody, and they were all always ready to go, I think. And that's a hell of an achievement, I think.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Because
I think you get a bit of distance on it, and I suppose you can enjoy it more as a listener rather than just like.
Yeah.
Although I've been listening to it, some of the ones with the two drummers, I didn't find myself getting quite jealous one stage. Thinking, I wish we'd have done this, you know, because that two drummer thing. I was talking to this, I've never experienced anything like it before or since. But that whole thing with having two drummers, which again was a daft idea of Mark's that everybody thought was, well, this isn't going to work. And once you do it, it's like, why didn't we think of that before? It was just fantastic.
Yeah. It's quite a, you weren't the only group doing it, were you, at the time? Obviously, Adam and Vince were doing it. And Section 25, I remember seeing around that time, they had two drummers. So yeah, it sounded brilliant. It wasn't, you know, the Glitter Band, they'd done it before, of course.
They had, yeah. But that did they actually play on the records, though, the Glitter Band? Was it not just all Gary Glitter and, was it Mike Leander? What was the name? I don't think they actually played on the records, did they?
I think they probably did. I'm not sure. No, you're saying that. I can't imagine who else it would be. I mean, obviously, Mark Leander's production is pretty
brilliant.
They sound. Yeah. But I mean, I'm pretty sure they played on them.
I know they played on the Glitter Band records, obviously.
Oh, yeah, the Glitter Band records. That's what I mean, yeah. But yeah, there was two drummer thing. You're right. It's quite odd that more people don't do it. I saw Khalees playing about 6-7 years ago. She had two drummers. It was like an all female band with two drummers. It was really good. But yeah, don't see it often enough.
I was talking to someone once, and he was the second drummer in a Gary Glitter tribute band. So, the bottom dropped out of that market overnight. I'll bet it was.
Because
that's a really awkward. Because that's kind of an elephant in the room. Because they were really good. The Gary Glitter stuff, wasn't it? I mean,
it was. Yeah. We did a Mabel. That's it. And we did one in Bangor in North Wales with the Glitter Band, obviously like quite late on in their career, and again just before the bottom completely dropped out of their world as well. But they were really good. But I did a weird mixture of Glitter Band songs and the Suite, and even though there was had nothing to do with the Suite at all, they were kind of trying to make it sound like they'd done Ballroom Blitz first time round. I was like, a bit of an odd career move, but there you go.
But did the last member of the Suite just die? Is that right? Was it Steve New? Well, not Steve New. He's the Richard. What's he called? Steve?
Yeah. Steve Priest.
Yeah.
He's
just died, hasn't he?
Yeah, a little while. Yeah, not long ago. Yeah.
Because that's one of the things I've been, you know, people going on about how punk rock and the music before that, it was crap and there was nothing in the charts. But it's a lot of rubbish, really, isn't it? There was a lot of good stuff.
Well, if you look back on that 70s and early 70s, it was
I think like immediately before punk, it was in the doldrums a bit. But yeah, like sort of 73, 74, it was 72. It was all really, and I was like 7, 8, 9 years old. But it was like sounded like it was like, sort of purpose built for me. All that.
Yeah, me too. But I mean, did things move quicker then? Because a year, you're talking about a year and a half. You're saying the music was in the from when it was brilliant to when it. I mean, that's nothing now, is it? That's people releasing one single. The urgency then was just. I mean, so again, that's something that The Fall managed to carry on. But I think most bands were like that. Buzzcocks had two albums out in a year in 1978.
Yeah,
there was all that thing you didn't put singles on albums. I think it's. Mark was less unusual then than it became later on, I think.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. Like, yeah, you didn't put singles on albums, or you definitely had standalone singles, like everyone did. It's that's definitely the thing you did. It was like, you know, it made singles more of an event as well, I think, that way.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there a way, though, that maybe The Fall's, like, rhythm or the plan of how they released stuff is different to, like, I don't know, prestigious indie bands who take themselves very seriously, but it's maybe not that unusual in... If you go back to kind of, yeah, 70s pop or, you know, that kind of like single album, short tour, you know, it's more like that than it is like, I don't know, whatever Wade would do or something, yeah. You know.
It's, well, it's, you know, it's Wade, one of the few groups I thought, well, they did do a maybe, standalone, yeah, a single. Yeah. So, but only the, yeah, one, but they did, yeah, do an event single. But, yeah, no, definitely, I think, to a degree, it's like, it was absolutely the norm in the early 80s to do that, certainly. And then,
yeah.
Just, you know, just time went by, The Fall were about the only group who was still doing it.
Feels like it links in a bit to those kind of unlikely influences like Kenny Everett's Worst Records and, you know, that kind of thing. It's always got a foot in some other camps outside, just like
it
just
is. Yeah, that was massive, that Kenny Everett album. That did the rounds with The Fall for years.
Please do. You can tell.
Is there a track on that we didn't do?
What a few people have, like, since, well, you put it in your piece and then, like, we've mentioned it a couple of times, quite a few people have, like, gone back and, like, you know, dug that out and listened to it, cracked down a copy. And, yeah, it's been quite a revelation.
Yeah, yeah. These people don't know about it. It's quite a shock to find that I'm Going to Spain wasn't a full song.
What, they covered that? Well, that was a cover version here. Who'd cover that?
I know.
One record like that seems surprising enough, but there are two versions.
Have
you? What? Well, you know,
you never fancy doing this pullover, Steve? No.
I was never mentioned that one, no.
And what else was on there?
Well, obviously, Transfusion.
Transfusion, yeah.
Didn't recover that. Mark just signed and nicked it for Old Crumble a bit, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else was on there? I'm Going to Spain. There was another one. There was a one where, what was the one where he buries his girlfriend? Or what was that one called?
I Want My Baby Back.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant album. But that, I mean, that was one of them. That was one of those with the, you know, where the rarity of records, like it's like Nuggets, you know, them songs. By luck, happened to be on there, and because there wasn't a million records flying about, you just kind of latched onto everything.
Yeah.
Because there must have been hundreds of those Nuggets that didn't make the albums, but everybody sort of cites that, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
no,
the
absolutely.
Ones that did make it on become a thing in their own right, don't they?
Yeah.
That was always big as well, wasn't it? Nuggets. Mark was always playing that. Well, it wasn't affecting it. A few, wasn't there? Was there?
What's that?
Nuggets. There was a few of them.
A few of them, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of them, yeah.
And Pebbles as well, as if I, or maybe I dreamt that. Was there a Pebbles album?
There was.
What was on that then?
I think it's similar, wasn't it?
They were shorter. they weren't as heavy as Nuggets, were they?
Smoother.
Very good. And I think we're getting running out of time here, and I still haven't been able to think of an aftershave song for the Beatles. That's really poor. I'm really disappointed with myself there. But if I'll email you if I can do it, or I might dub it in.
Do you mention having a shave on a day in the life? I think he might.
No, he combs his hair. He doesn't have a shave.
Brown shoe.
Oh, no, hang on. Yoko. Just want to have a shave.
Yes.
Have a shave. Not there, but not aftershave.
He was shaving then. That's good for bugger. He never had a shave. Right, well, thank you very much. That's really appreciate that. Really enjoy that. So,
thanks great. For it's having us fun. In.
Yeah.
And
good luck with everything with the book.
Oh, thank
thanks
you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, mate. Okay. All the best.
Take care,
Becky.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Episodes released every second Wednesday, so watch for episode 6 in 2 weeks. Please follow us on Twitter, at Old Brother Show, where you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes or tell your friends about us. You should also check out Excavate, The Wonderful and Frightening World of the Fall, available from all good bookstores. See you again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.